Hey, do you got a subscription to the Globe and Mail?
Yeah, actually, Megan, I've got that open right now.
Okay, don't make fun of me, but I want to check the Globe and Mail bestseller list to see if my book, Winnipeg, Visions of Canada from an Indigenous Center, has made it.
Okay. Hardcover nonfiction as of June 8th, 2024. At 10, there are dads way worse than you, Glenn Boozen and Priscilla Witt. Down 5 from 4 to 9, it's Closer Together, Sophie Gregoire Trudeau. At 8, it's You Never Know, Tom Selleck and Ellis Henneken. Eric Larson in at 7 this week, The Demon of Unrest, down one spot from last week. New entry at 6, it's The New Menopause, Mary Claire Haver. And at number 5, another new entry, it's Negan Sinclair.
Number 5? Holy smoke, I'm a bit overwhelmed.
Yeah, listen, you are just behind comedian Bill Maher, who's a pretty big deal, and just ahead of Magnum P.I. and the country's most sympathetic soon-to-be ex-wife. I mean, man, you are rocking it.
Okay, I'm not going to let this get into my head too much, but things really have to change around here now.
Okay, I'm not sure I want to hear this, but lay it on me.
Okay, my agent and publisher has just texted me and has indicated that when you address me, you must now say best-selling author Negan Sinclair.
Isn't that a bit pretentious? I guess you've earned it, though.
Okay, I'm also going to need a leather wingback chair when we record, and a smoking jacket, and a pipe. I don't smoke, but I need all these trappings of a successful writer handy just in case I feel, I don't know, a creative surge coming on. And is there a way we can put a fireplace in the studio?
What? This is ridiculous. The fireplace is a total non-starter. But I'll tell you what. Your book is doing so well, and you are my brother, so I'm going to give in on all the other stuff for now.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you creating the right environment for me now that I'm a big-time writer.
You know, Negan, I do think there is one more thing that you need.
Hey, what's that?
An intervention.
The Winnipeg Free Press proudly presents, in partnership with CJNU 93.7 FM, Negan and the Lone Ranger. Here are your hosts, Negan Sinclair and Dan the Lone Ranger Lett.
Bonjour, Tansé. Hello, greetings, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Negan and the Lone Ranger. And we are taping this in the wake of a bomber loss in the opening game of the CFL season. We are in mourning here in the Negan Lone Ranger studio.
It's still early.
So, like most good Winnipeggers, I was listening to the game last night on radio, and of course, our good friends over there in CJOB. I've been listening to them for decades, and
excellent job covering the Bombers.
Always. Yeah. And, you know, long time, of course, Bob Irving and all the great people over there, and now the new cover team. Anyways, so CJOB's on. So I have it on again this morning when I'm driving around, coming to the studio here. And what do I hear? But CJOB has a new sponsorship partner, Krispy Kreme Donuts. And today is Donut Day here in the world, I guess. Is it Donut
Day? I think it's International Donut Day, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I, in this hyper competitive, lean and mean, you know, era of, you know, media, I mean, radio, I mean, they feel the pain as much as we do in the newspaper industry. But I got to tell you, hitching your wagon to Krispy Kreme and then offering some crazy conspiracy theory about how they're better than Tim Hortons donuts. I mean, whoa.
This could be a national scandal.
National scandal. Like, I'm telling you, I have years ago, I tried a Krispy Kreme donut. And with no disrespect to the Krispy Kreme people, because they got to eat too, I guess. Hopefully something more than just donuts. But they're doing business. But I mean, you know, I don't go to the United States, where Krispy Kreme is from, to eat donuts. Donuts are, if you'll pardon small I, they are an indigenous cuisine. Of Canada.
Of Canada.
Small eye.
You're going to get us. I got to see the emails coming in now.
No. But I mean, they really are. Like, we are. You can't go anywhere in the world and have a decent donut that really isn't a riff off Tim Hortons or from Toronto Country Style, you know, donuts. The Krispy Kreme donut is completely different. And, you know, just in case they may be buying display ads in the Winnipeg Free Press. I'm not going to tell you what it was. The experience was like eating a Krispy Kreme donut. Well,
on this, in this morning's announcements, and they're talking about, you know, our good friends over there, sponsorship. They're probably getting bylines to read and from their sponsorship, but they were even comparing like caloric. Which donut, Tim Hortons or Krispy Kreme, has more calories, which I thought, are we at this stage where we're debating fitness and health when it comes to donuts?
Yeah. As far as that, you know, the nutritional information with donuts, I will give you the exact same line I used when I heard somebody combine the words light and peanut butter, which is why? God, why?
So as the guy who works in the radio industry here, you know, kudos to all of the good folks at CJOB. Other good radio stations are, of course, available. But I will say that when you're given like a live read script, things like that, what's that sound I'm hearing? Oh, yeah, that's the sound of the point being missed going straight past us. Who really is caring about the caloric content of a donut?
No, exactly. Yeah.
If you're wanting a donut... You want a donut.
I don't want to know.
Well, now that we've had probably the most impassioned debate we've ever had on the Nigong Lone Ranger podcast, it was a kind of funny moment driving over here and hearing, but it is the start of the new Bomber season. Good luck to all of the players and the staff. And of course, cards on the table. I do a little bit of work over there with working on the Orange Shirt Day game, the Truth and Reconciliation game on September 27th this year. So please check it out. But speaking of sugary sweet things, the Tuxedo by-election is upon us. As our listeners will be turning this on, you will be seeing people flock going by the dozens or the individuals to their by-election posts in Tuxedo, which is the seat that's been vacated by former Manitoba Premier Heather Stephenson in a highly weirdly surprisingly, maybe not surprising, contentious seat that the NDP historically has never really been competitive in the recent years anyways, but is now competitive in arguably one of the most wealthiest areas of the city. Also an area that is now going to be occupied by the Noweo Dena project, where Treaty 1-7 First Nations will be investing literally billions of dollars in that neighborhood. And so it looks like a competitive scene over there between the front runner, which is Lawrence Pinsky representing the Conservatives, and then Nurse, very highly touted and supported Nurse from the NDP, Carla Compton. And it will be very competitive.
Yeah. So this is, by-elections every once in a while are not foregone conclusions, and be important to the balance of the political marketplace in Manitoba. This is both of those things. Flashback to last fall's election. NDP don't campaign in Tuxedo. They do not consider a winnable seat.
It makes sense because party, the former premier, or at the time the premier,
Was Heather Stephenson owned the seat. Nobody's ever really seriously threatened the Tories in Tuxedo. Former Premier Gary Feldman held Tuxedo. But with virtually no campaign. The NDP only spent $1,500. I mean, I don't even know that would pay for lawn signs for Tuxedo, $1,500. So they only spent $1,500 and they ended up coming within a couple of hundred
votes.
268 votes.
268 votes. So what's the analysis? Okay. So depending on who you're talking to, the Conservatives, progressive Conservatives, ran a very unpopular candidate. Heather Stephenson was a very unpopular candidate. Leaders typically don't campaign a lot in their own riding. So if there is some sort of momentum moving towards another party, they can be caught off guard sometime. But then, the more profound issue for the provincial progressive Conservatives is the toxic campaign that they ran. So the parental rights bullshit sorry, you know, strategy. I meant to say strategy. It came out as bullshit. And the vote for us, we're the party that won't spend a dime searching the landfill for the remains of missing Indigenous women. So people were so creeped out by both of those things that it leveled the playing field very nearly in the last election. And so the speculation or the question remaining is, did Heather Stephenson break Tuxedo? Did she break the underlying foundation?
Like one of the most secure seats in the whole city.
Yeah.
And then, you know, on speaking of toxic campaigns or toxic messages, and the rather smallly, we covered it anyways with the Winnipeg Free Press, but the election campaign over there, the by-election campaign, which typically doesn't get a lot of headlines, got a lot of headlines this week because Lawrence Pinsky from the Conservatives is accusing the NDP, not the candidate, not Carla Compton, but her fellow NDP people in government. That's Nahani Fontaine, Jennifer Chen, both high-profile MLAs, of being complicit with Israeli genocide and talking not about the Hamas terror enough, and particularly Jennifer Chen.
I'm just going to, yep. So I think you want to go back and restate it as something about complicit with the Israeli genocide because they're against.
Yeah.
So sort of go back and describe the thing again, because I think.
So let's, I'll go back to, mm-hmm. yeah. So the election campaign turned fairly toxic on the current issues by Lawrence Pinsky from the Conservatives accusing not Carla Compton, his opponent, but other NDP affiliates, particularly Nahani Fontaine and Jennifer Chen, as being somewhat anti-Semitic, being people who are not on the board with Israel on the current conflict in Gaza, and particularly not spreading information that is true. And so this has become a really big passion issue for, I think, a lot of people in the city. It's something that's been a hot button issue. They was even came up at a University of Manitoba medical school graduation speech. And everyone in Winnipeg seems to be talking about Gaza these days and talking about the issue. And it came up in the by-election campaign.
So, you know, in compressed, here's the dilemma when it comes to raising this issue and discussing it. There were undoubtedly horrible atrocities committed by Hamas and its attack on Israel in October that kicked off this whole thing. The resulting military response from Israel has been, I think by objective standards, very fierce to the point where it is concerning some people that the response is not in keeping with the original Hamas atrocities. I don't like, as an opinion writer, I don't like being trapped between two negatives. It makes it very, very difficult. But the point is, in public debate, in social media, anytime anybody brings up the issue, basically there are a lot of people that are very a lot of sympathy for Palestine, the Palestinian people, who believe that the military offensive by Israel in Gaza is, if it hasn't already, is approaching a genocide. It's reckless and indiscriminate. A lot of Jewish people and a lot of people who just support the interests of the state of Israel believe that what Israel is doing is a just and measured response to the atrocities committed against them. And I mean, what Hamas did in its original attack, unspeakable, gross stuff.
Unacceptable.
But the problem, of course, is that now that Lawrence Pinsky is trying to turn this into an issue in Tuxedo, apparently on the theory that there are enough Jewish people and people who support the interests of the Jewish people that they will be offended and vote against the NDP. And I think that may prove to be a colossal, mistake on the progressive conservative's part. I don't know what you think.
I mean, it'll be curious whether this has any traction when it comes to people who vote in a by-election. I mean, usually what happens in by-elections is kind of single issues that people get impassioned about. But it's also a forum on the government. And so we've got a government in Manitoba that's fairly well-liked at the moment. And I think kind of across the board, particularly in Winnipeg, I would say, maybe urban across the board. But then you've also got this big issue involving, and of course I've written on the issue of what's happening in Gaza, and I've been in one way or another, stoked a few feelings across the city with my columns about what I've thought about the issue. And so people can read those if they want. So I'm not here to defend my position on this, but to say that what you've got here is you've got a Jewish lawyer running for office, and what you've got is a party, the NDP, who have very strong opinions, and particularly in the case of Jennifer Chen and Nahani Fontaine, an Indigenous woman and a woman of a visible minority, who have strong opinions on the feelings around Israel's actions. So, I mean, I'd be very interested to see whether this has any role to play within this election, this by-election, and whether it'll have any traction in gaining Pinsky any seats, because what he's done is he's then said that does Premier Wapkinu support what he calls extremism?
Yeah, I think it's the use of the word extremism.
Our social media commentary, is that extremism or talking about that people are dying as a result of this conflict, yeah, which is what Nahani Fontaine and Jennifer Chen have been talking about?
So I think the word extremism to me is so overused by people of all political stripes that it's starting to lose meaning. But let's back up to political strategies that rest on appealing to a single religion or cultural group. I think there are many more examples in this province in particular where that has backfired. Go back to the 2015 election, and Stephen Harper's Conservatives are in tough against the NDP and a surging Liberal Party. The PC MP, the Conservative MP for River Heights, or I guess in federal would be Winnipeg South Centre, at a debate that I helped moderate, was asked a series of questions about the pressing issues of the day. Whenever she was asked a question, immigration, the economy, whatever, she opened up a book and she would start reading anti-Israeli, what were perceived to be anti-Israeli or anti-Zionist comments by Liberal politicians. And it was like extraordinary that it didn't matter what she was asked, she would come back reading out of this book. People were booing and hissing. This is, you know, it was ridiculous. The theory was that if you portray the Liberals as anti-Israeli or anti-Jewish or anti-Zionist, that that would help
particularly the
conservatives. Yeah. And it backfired spectacularly. And honestly, Joyce Bateman was mercifully, sent off to the to the trash can of Manitoba politics. But it's the same thing that, like, when people say, well, you've got to run a Francophone candidate in St. Boniface. Well, you know, people who know that riding now, the way it's changed through immigration, but also just through socioeconomic factors, new developments, housing developments, things are no longer two-dimensional. Winnipeg South, another huge riding where, it used to be established conservative old money, like those are the people who moved into White Ridge and Linden. That's not what it is now. It is actually one of the most diverse neighborhoods in Canada.
One of the biggest Manitoba housing developments in that neighborhood, never mind the huge investment by Treaty One First Nations in the neighborhood. Like, that is an interesting riding showing a changing Manitoba.
So, I mean, my hope is that bringing up Gaza doesn't become an issue one way or the other. I think that Lawrence Pinsky should really, there's a lot of other things I'd like to hear him talk about first than what he thinks about Middle Eastern conflict and politics. If that's the card they're going to play, though, to me, that sounds like they didn't learn anything in the last election where, trying to pick the most, sort of inflammatory issue and throw that around hoping it sticks to your opponent. How'd that work for you?
Well, I mean, yeah. We don't often do big disagreements, but I would disagree with you that, I mean, I think the key here is
timestamp the disagreement.
The point is to get attention to a by-election, because I think that when you've got a popular government, you're probably faced with the issue of trying to get voter turnout. And so, how can you get your, how can you fire up people who otherwise might not come out to the polls? Well, talk about an issue that's a hot button issue that would drive people to have an interest there. You know, I would say that if you also
he could have driven his car into something, you know, like he could have, you know, like he could.
I don't think that's the kind of headline you probably wanted, but
yeah, like, but no, but I mean that, but that metaphorically speaking, like I agree. But the thing is that the by-election doesn't need attention outside of Tuxedo.
This is exactly the point I was going to make. To your point, Nigan, it's definitely drawing attention to it, but arguably for the wrong reasons, because if you're a resident in Tuxedo, you want this to be a by-election campaign about issues that affect your neighborhood. And potentially it's just being, it's once again, a global conflict that's being used as a proxy.
We'll open up my inbox and I will show you the deeply impassioned, I would say perhaps individuals, but individuals with a great deal of power who have voiced to me their immense displeasure over anybody that wants to talk about anything other than a vociferous support for Israel's current actions. Yeah. And anyone who describes anything otherwise are called extremists or propagandists.
Do you honestly believe, though, that that is the predominant public opinion in Tuxedo? Because
that's what I'm asking the question. I mean, clearly that if you've got someone who's playing this as their main card, and that's where you're getting the most amount of attention as a result. I would say also, I would add this. Premier Wahb Kanu has said that he's calling for a ceasefire. He's also condemned Hamas. Destruction of Hamas. And what he said is at the last part, which is for Manitobans to get along, which tells me that he has an ear on the ground to realize that this is a very important issue for a significant section of the Jewish community trying to walk in some middle line, not just talking about condemning Israel's actions, but also saying that they are justified in some way and somehow in their current ways in which they're trying their best to rid the world of Hamas in whatever way that they see that to be. And so I think that, you know, even Premier Wahb Kanu realizes that this is an issue that you've got to listen to the Pinskys of the world.
Well, it could be. In this room, though, it's 2-1. So now that we've established that you're wrong.
Forgive me. Yeah, I'm still sitting right.
Yeah, is that how it works?
It's democracy,
I liked
man.
It better when Adam was more quiet.
Yeah, no, you you know for sure that I am so far on the fence that you can't see the post.
Yeah, but, you know, we're going to pivot from that moment of levity.
Speaking of Manitobans getting together.
Yeah, Manitobans getting together.
Well, speaking of politicians trying to bring people together.
Okay, I was trying to figure out how long the rope was on that pivot, but yes, actually, I tend to believe that this week's feature interview is an indication of the enormous reach and influence of this podcast. That this guy, who's like, he's a big time political figure right now, he contacted us and he begged us to come on the podcast.
Well, almost, yes. It was more an email or two that
and a personal connection.
And that I have known this individual for a long period of time and invited him a series of months ago. Actually, I would say we talked about this almost a year ago to get this individual. Nahit Nanshi is a national figure, former mayor of Calgary. And to be honest, was in the pasture of Canadian politics, not interested in any way to come back into the fold, was a political commentator with myself on a TV news program. And we talked regularly. We'd often see each other at conferences and have coffee and so on. And I just sort of posited, hey, why did you, you know, think about coming on the podcast? Next thing you know, we get a message out of the blue. And I think what prompts this perhaps is that he's now running to be the NDP leader in Alberta.
Yes, running to be the leader of the Alberta NDP and, you know, is considered to be, it's quite a seismic event in the history of the NDP in that province, but also in all of Alberta politics. And as you'll hear during the interview, you know, his mere presence in the race has prompted some interesting structural changes to the way support for the NDP is distributed throughout the province. And as well, like, I don't know him as well as you do, but I did actually many years ago when he was still the mayor of Calgary. I did have a chance to interview him at the News Cafe, the Winnipeg Free Press News Cafe in downtown Winnipeg in the Exchange District. And rest in peace. And he was a fantastic interview. And in fact, on his way over to do the interview, he claims the story is exaggerated, but Brian Bowman, former mayor of Winnipeg, claims it's true. On his way to the interview, they were walking, I think, from the Fairmont Hotel, and Nahida Nenshi saw the barriers at Portage and Main and was so, like, offended aghast. By these aghast that, as Brian says, he scaled the barrier and attempted to walk across the street in, you know, like he did wait for the traffic to pass, but he was going to cross the street on street level and not in the underground. He thought that that was ridiculous. So the version of the story from there really depends on who you're talking to. Brian does in the tradition of good storytelling, which involves a little bit of embellishment, says that there were screeching tires and tire smoke and that Nahid Nenshi's, you know, political career almost came to an end at Portage and Main.
And that the skid marks remained for days.
Yeah. Mr. Nenshi claims that that's a slight exaggeration. But I will say, I really thought the whole Portage and Main thing was a bunch of hooey. Like that it really wasn't an important issue. And I interviewed him for a live webcast from the News Cafe. And I will say, right after that, I wrote a column saying that he, the mayor of Calgary, had come to Winnipeg and had changed my mind about Winnipeg's most iconic intersections, and the rest of you readers have been paying for it ever since.
That's right. And the story has just taken off from there. And of course, we all know what's happening with Portage and Main now. We're clearly going to eventually get to be able to walk across that street, whatever that looks like, walk across it, above it, certainly not below it, but at some point. This interview is, for any other reason, I encourage people to listen to the end, not only because it's a fascinating interview, but you will get to hear the complete vexedness, the absolute complicatedness and contradiction. I would just call it an earth-shattering moment where an individual from Calgary has to answer for wearing an Oiler jersey.
Yeah, during the Stanley Cup playoffs, and anybody who says politicians don't make sacrifices has never contemplated the dilemma that
this is a massive dilemma. And for all of you who listen outside of Canada, for our three listeners outside of Canada
in Hawaii,
just so you know, this is a national debate right now. Is Edmonton Canada's team? And we're about to face the verge in the Stanley Cup Finals. But let's get to our feature interview with NDP leadership, Alberta NDP leadership hopeful Nahid Nenshi, and the generous time that he gave us while the election is just underway in Alberta. So let's take it away. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure to be here with you. And I know we've been trying to schedule this, so thanks for being flexible. And I'm happy to talk to all my friends in Manitoba. Tansay.
Well, I mean, let's start out by talking about today is the first day of the NDP leadership vote. I mean, we've been running a campaign for what seems like quite a long time. It was not maybe that long, but why run now? That's really, I guess, the question that everybody is curious about after a long, successful run as the mayor of Calgary, in which in many ways you became not just a provincial figure, but a national figure. It seems that maybe this might be an unexpected direction that you went as what many people watching your career would have thought.
Yeah, you know, maybe me too. So I jumped into this race about 3.5 months ago. Feels like last week and also feels like 5 years ago. And as you say, today is the first day of 3 weeks of voting, which makes this a very interesting campaign from a political campaign perspective, because, you know, usually what we call our GOTV phase, that stands for get out the vote, lasts one day on election day. And now we've got to figure out how to do a 3 week long GOTV process to get our supporters to vote, to keep the volunteers energized and excited until the election is finished on June the 22nd. Anyway, so we're in the thick of it now. And yes, I probably ask myself every day, why am I doing this again? Again, why am I doing this? You know, I did my taxes at the end of April when they finally gave me a day off. And I sort of looked at my form and went, huh. So I'm significantly reducing my income, significantly increasing the hours I work, and probably increasing my stress level by a factor of 10. Why am I doing this again?
Only 10?
Maybe 100. Because I've actually been having a great retirement for the last 2.5 years, but at least let me fool myself into thinking it's only 10. But fundamentally, you know, we have a provincial government in Alberta that is, it's beyond the pale. You know, I was in politics for 11 years. I have been a student of politics my whole life, and I have never experienced a government like this. While I was mayor, I had 6 different premiers that I dealt with from 3 different political parties. And sometimes we agreed and sometimes we disagreed, but I always kind of thought we were more or less rowing in the same direction of trying to improve the community. And what we have now is something completely different. Maybe it's a preview of what we might be getting in the federal government going forward, or maybe you in Manitoba had a real small taste of this before your last election. But this is a government that is completely controlled by movement people, people who've sort of always wanted to have power. But once they got the power, it's not clear they have any idea what to do with it. So sometimes I call them the dog that caught the car. And I have never before seen a government that is so fundamentally disinterested in governing. They don't actually care, it seems, about running the healthcare system or the education system or all the various things provincial governments have to do. They just want to pick fights and consolidate power. And I was a political commentator, as you may know, like you, Nagan, before I got into this world. And it made for endless fodder for political commentary because they were always doing just things that were out of control. But I realized that these are very real people's lives at stake. And right now, in this difficult times, as comfortable as my life had been, I think every one of us is called upon to not be a bystander, that every one of us is called upon to do what we can to try and bring society back from the brink, but also to build a better community for everybody. And so I thought, well, I better get engaged again. Maybe I can help the opposition party. Maybe I can find a candidate to get behind. And as I talked to people in every corner of the province, you know, I just kept hearing kind of the same thing, which was, look, Nahid, you don't have a lot of skills. There's not a lot of good things you're good at, which is true. Do not ask me to come help you fix your car or patch your drywall. Bad things will happen if I try. But there is one thing you're good at, which is trying to convene people, trying to bring people together around a common cause. And the times are so fraught right now, and time is so difficult right now, that we're all called upon to do what we have to do. And in your case, you got to do the thing you're good at. It's time to throw back in. So here we are. And what's been fascinating to me over the last 3 months is, you know, when I jumped in, I was actually quite nervous that my style of politics is out of style. We used to call it politics in full sentences because I talk a lot. But it was really engaging with people at an intellectual level, inviting people into complex conversations that didn't have easy answers, and really reaching out to people to say, we're about more than ourselves. We need to be about our communities. And I really did think that was out of style. That is not what we're hearing in politics right now. And so I wasn't sure how people would respond. And the last 3 months have been remarkable. The movement that we've created, the crowds that are coming out, the folks that I'm talking to have been way, way, way beyond my wildest expectations. You know, I had a number in mind of how many memberships we might be able to sell as a real stretch target, the outside number we could sell over a 4-month campaign or a 2-month campaign, because there was a membership time limit. And we sold more than that in the first day.
Wow.
And so as we've been traveling around the province talking to people, I've swiftly realized that it's not because people are super excited about seeing this handsome face again. It's actually, and it's not about me at all, it's actually that people are fed up with a politics that teaches them to be small. that teaches them that this is as good as we can ever hope, and we have to defend what we have rather than open ourselves up to the possibility of something better. And I think I don't spend a lot of time in Manitoba these days, but I feel like the precursor of this was your recent election in Manitoba.
That's fascinating.
Where you really did have a conversation about being small versus being big. If I can be, if I can boil it down to something that simplistic.
And also about human, right? So mm-hmm. about humanity, right? That was really what that election was a lot about.
Yeah. And we're seeing it now in Alberta. And I hope that that's momentum we can continue. We don't have a provincial election now for 3.5 years. So whoever is elected leader in a couple weeks' time here, 3 weeks' time, we'll then have to manage 3.5 years in opposition and try and keep that momentum going.
One of the interesting things that I think Nagan and I both came across in doing our research is that you went to school with Danielle Smith.
I did.
I'm not sure whether to ask mostly about that or mostly about you posted, somebody asked what you were doing 30 years ago on October 26, 1992, and you responded that you're at a pub at the University of Calgary with classmates, including Danielle Smith, and he who shall not be named watching referendum results, and that they tied you to a chair. First of all, I want to know about who should not be named. Who's that?
Oh, well, you know, it was really interesting to be at the University of Calgary in the early 90s because it was a very political place. And so it was the birth of the Reform Party. So Preston Manning was on campus all the time. And in that class that I'm talking about, the folks in that class included Danielle Smith, who was the president of the campus PCs. And at that point, it meant something to be a PC and not a reformer on campus. It meant you were more moderate, but she was the president of the campus PCs. But also in that class were later MP Rob Anders, a guy who was Danielle's first husband, actually, but also was the pollster for the Reform Party, called Sean McKinsley, a long, long time staffer in the Liberal PMOs with Chrétien and Trudeau, called Kevin Bosch. And he who might not be named, a guy you may have heard of called Ezra Levant, who was a good friend of mine back in the day. The professor of that class was a guy called Peter Lougheed. Wow. And the TA was a fellow called Ian Brody, who was later Harper's chief of staff. And by the way, there was not in that class, but there was this guy on campus, graduate student, who kind of followed Manning around, but really kept to himself. And nobody could figure out what he was about because he was so introverted and so shy. And his name was Stephen somebody. I think he went on to do stuff as well.
Wow. Like, well, that's quite a lineage. So I guess the obvious question, having noted that Premier Smith was once a committed progressive conservative. How much has she changed from the person you knew back in school?
Well, you know, I've known her a little bit over the years, and you know, certainly we had a lot of contact when she was leader of the Wild Rose Party and I was mayor. And, you know, she had changed a little bit over time. She'd sort of gotten increasingly radicalized. There's a lot of Smithology, a lot of schools of Danielle Smith trying to figure out what happened to her. I would suggest that she had a very early political experience when she was on the school board in Calgary, and the entire school board got fired by the then PC government because they were dysfunctional. I think that experience for her was a difficult one because I think that she had some undue blame. I don't know. I think in some ways she was the victim. She was the one being bullied. But I think that was a formative experience for her, plus some time at the Fraser Institute. But then when she got into journalism, she found that there was an opportunity to have a willing audience for the more shocking things she said. So, you know, she wrote columns on how there shouldn't be computers in classrooms. She wrote columns on Indigenous issues that would curl your hair if you read them today. Most famous one was something saying cigarettes aren't really bad for you. And so I think doing all of that, she found that if she said outrageous things, you know, it hit the dopamine receptor in your brain like social media does now. And But in her case, she spent so much time in this echo chamber of people just saying, yes, 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 I agree with you. You're saying the things that matter, that she started to believe those things herself. So this person who is the premier right now is not at all the person I went to school with. She is something that is completely different. And as I say, shows remarkable disinterest in anything beyond power. And to me, that's what gets really dangerous.
There, you mentioned the membership drive, which it's hard not to spend some time talking about, because the fact that the NDP went from 16,000 memberships in December 31st to over 85,000, and most of those, or a great deal of them anyways, the majority, is in Calgary. Mm-hmm. And the top six membership areas are all in Calgary. How much of this would you say, and I think it's okay to be a little bit talking, I mean, you are talking about yourself as the leader and running as the leader. How much is it a favorability towards you, and how much is it towards a progressive message?
Hard to say. What we do know is that, so we had 16,000 members on December 31st, but about half of them lapsed in the month of January. So the day that Rachel Notley stepped down, there were 8,000 active members of the NDP in Alberta. There's now, as you say, over 85,000. So we grew by more than 10 times during the course of this race. And all provincial political parties don't release their membership numbers regularly, but it's probably safe to say that the Alberta NDP, just I want to say that again, the Alberta NDP are now the largest provincial political party in Canada by membership. That's pretty amazing. And one of the things that the analysis that we've been reading a lot of sort of misses is, so for your Manitoba listeners, I'll give you a bit of context, which is the Alberta NDP has always been so back up. So in Manitoba, you got one city that's two-thirds of the population. Alberta is quite unique. It's the only province where there are two almost equally sized cities. I always point out Calgary is much larger than Edmonton in reality, but we think of them as two sort of equal size centers of power. And so the political map in Alberta is quite different. People say you have to win two out of three legs of the stool, Calgary, Edmonton, and the rest of Alberta. Now, the rest of Alberta, we tend to block as a monolith and say rural Alberta, and that's not the case at all. You've got some pretty big cities like Red Deer and Lethbridge. You've got really rural agricultural communities, and you have everything in between. And I think one mistake that we often make is lumping all that together and calling it rural. But nonetheless, those three sets of the stool. And the NDP's power was always in Edmonton. So they actually, we hold every single seat in Edmonton. And in the previous election, where the NDP did very poorly, we held every seat but one in Edmonton. And so we have a power base, and the party is sort of based there, and Edmonton, of course, is the capital. But they did very well in Calgary in the last election, winning just over half of the seats, 51% of the seats. And when we jumped into this race and started the membership sales, yes, it's absolutely true that we increased the number of members in Calgary by 10 times. We also increased the number of members in Edmonton by 7 times. We also increased the number of members outside of Edmonton and Calgary by almost 10 times. So the party has grown massively everywhere, which is really remarkable. And right now the membership is about 40% in Calgary, 20% in Edmonton, 30% in the rest of the province. So it is a bit of a power shift, but I think the really important thing is that we've grown everywhere. And to me, that's very exciting, because that shows that there's a real desire for change. So yes, our campaign sold a lot of those memberships. But I really do think it's not just about me, but it's about what I represent, that I'm representing that we can do politics differently, that we don't have to do this defensive style of politics that has become so popular now, or this wishing for an imaginary mythological past, you know, make America great again. For whom? Take back Alberta? From whom? right? And that's what our political discourse has trained us to do. But the most interesting thing about my campaign, my slogan of my campaign is "For Alberta, for all of us." And when I wrote that slogan before I jumped into the campaign, I'm a marketer by profession, so I take some direct ability to get into these things. The number of times I redesigned that logo with our poor designer, you'd never know. But when I wrote that slogan, I thought I would say it like that: "For Alberta, for all of us," making the point that the current government is not working for the betterment of the province and certainly not for everyone in the province. But what I've really learned is that the incredible power of that slogan, inadvertently, is actually that little word "for," F-O-R. Because our politics over the last decade or so have trained us to be against. And in Alberta, that means being against Ottawa, being against the Prime Minister, being against vulnerable trans kids, being against newcomers, being against frontline workers, teachers, and nurses, and essentially being against our neighbors and being against each other. And when we jumped in and we said, "We are for all of us," it really struck a chord with people who said, "Yeah, that's what we're actually about." You know, when you grow up on the Canadian prairies, it is impossible to think small under a sky that is that big. And so people are saying, "You're speaking to why we live here, why we love it here, why we want to be here. And our politics is not speaking to us that way." So the trick is, if I'm successful at the end of the month, the trick is, how do I sustain that positivity and that optimism for the future through 3.5 more years of this destructive UCP government?
So I'm interested, you know, running for leader of the NDP is in any province is different, I would argue, than running for premier in almost any other party, or running for leader in almost any other party, because of the makeup of the traditional NDP membership. So, you know, you not only have to appeal to long-time party members, you also have to appeal to public sector unions and trade unions, and then there's the general public. You know, your opponents in the leadership race tried to make a big deal out of the fact that, you know, you haven't been a long-time NDP member, and that you might be estranged from the labor movement. First of all, do you accept that getting to be leader of an NDP party is slightly more complex, perhaps, than running for leaders of other party?
Yeah, for sure. For the reasons you mentioned, and one other one, which is that unlike every other political party in Canada, most people don't know this. So your Conservative Party in Manitoba is not officially affiliated with the Conservative Party of Canada. Right. Even the UCP in Alberta is not officially affiliated with the Conservative Party. The Liberals are not officially affiliated with the Liberal parties. In fact, BC Liberals have changed their name because they were more conservative than Liberal. But the NDP is different. The NDP is a federation. So when you join the provincial party, you also automatically join the federal party. And so that is a complication, because in Manitoba, in Alberta, in Saskatchewan, and in British Columbia, if the NDP wants to win provincially, they have to appeal to people who vote for different parties federally. Just math. And so a lot of people were hesitant to join the party because of that affiliation. As it turned out, not that hesitant, given the party memberships that went through the roof. But in the past, we also had set-asides for voting for union members. And when the committee decided to set the rules this time, they got rid of that. So it is true that unions get, I think, 2 seats on the 87-seat provincial council.
Right.
And those numbers are incorrect, but it's a very, very small portion. You know, almost not even a rounding error portion. So while workers' rights are critical, while that is the foundation of the party, the labor unions certainly do not control the party. They haven't before, and they will not in the future. But nonetheless, I was actually quite proud of the fact that I got an endorsement from the largest private sector union, the Building Trades Association, for my labor policies, and quite proud that when you talk to the labor folks who dealt with me when I was mayor, they are generally, not generally, uniformly positive about that experience. And what I've said to labor is what I've said to everyone, which is, look, you're not going to get everything you want. That's just not how this works. And I've got 11 years as management in a unionized environment when I was mayor. But what I can promise you is you'll always get a fair hearing. You'll always know where I'm coming from. You'll always have an open door for us to have real conversations. You're not going to get spun. You're not going to get lied to. And you'll always be treated with respect. And so ultimately on that front, on the labor front, I think that that has been very successful. We, you know, I was running against one of the big labor bosses, the president of the AFL, the Alberta Federation of Labor. And the Alberta Federation of Labor, of course, endorsed him, but apparently it was a very controversial vote. He's dropped out of the race subsequently, but no one else has really received any big union endorsements except for me, which is interesting. And the other thing, though, is the incredibly warm welcome that I've gotten from existing members. Like, okay, I could sit here and say, look, the existing members are only 10% now of the total membership. But in reality, you know, a week after I launched, I had an event in Red Deer where, you know, traditionally a conservative leaning place where the NDP do not currently hold a seat. And, you know, it was packed. People were climbing the walls. I had to go back to Red Deer to do another event in the same hall. And I said, why am I going back to the same place, to the same hall? And I was told because the waiting list was longer than the number of people we could fit in. Wow. And it's Edmonton, you know, where the core base of the NDP has been. And we sort of picked a hall where the NDP has traditionally done events, just symbolically that, you know, here we are in this hall. And the people who work in the hall say they've never seen so many people show up for an NDP event. In fact, I had to remind my staff, my volunteers, that I used to be the mayor, so I do care about things like fire codes. And so if the hall seats 600, do not take 1,400 RSVPs. Mm-hmm. But it was really impressive. And at those events, I would say, how many of you are longtime NDP members? How many of you have recently bought a membership? And at the beginning, you know, we were getting half to two thirds longtime NDP members. And they would walk up to me afterwards and they'd say, listen, I've been a member forever and I've been waiting for someone like you. You know, you're what we want, you're what we need. And so the welcome that I've gotten from the existing members has been amazing. And quite frankly, only one of my competitors has sort of tried to subject me to a purity test of not being a long-term NDP member. And it really hasn't worked for her, I'm sorry to say.
So much about Alberta election campaigns are about energy, sort of energy, energy, energy. And then I think now part of that might be related to climate change, although there's still some question on that, whether, especially considering the rhetoric around Premier Smith's comment around trying to, you know, whatever sustainable energy looks like, or trying to focus on changing technology or so on. I mean, but it's still built predominantly on gas and oil. In the past, that's been a sort of Achilles heel that people criticized Rachel Notley for. Do you think that one of the solves or the correctives or the shield that you may have, being the mayor of Calgary and having a history of working with oil and gas companies, but then also having an NDP environmental commitment, which is, as you mentioned, both provincial and federally. I mean, the NDP has a national platform for thinking about or focusing on green energy or green sustainability. That's a complex issue in Alberta, but how do you balance that? Because I think that generally people have won elections in Alberta on develop, 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 particularly the oil sands. And now there's really, I mean, it's just undeniable, the forest fire situation just next door in BC, in northern Alberta. Of course, we know that the, well, millions of dollars of damage that fires have caused. How do you balance that? And then is it because you're the mayor of Calgary that people are maybe interested in hearing an NDP voice on this topic of energy?
Yeah, look, there's a lot in there. And so let's unpack it a little bit. So yes, it is the case that while I was mayor of Calgary, we developed a new motto for the city of Calgary, which was be part of the energy. And there's a lot of meanings to that. It certainly is talking about the energy sector, but it's also talking about entrepreneurism and the energy and the excitement of the city and the fact that we really think of ourselves as the new world. You know, it doesn't matter where you come from or how you worship or who your daddy was or where you went to school. We really care about the ideas that you have. And so that really is a real important part of the culture of Alberta. But the challenge that the NDP has had in the last couple of elections is you get to the doors and people say, you know, love Rachel, don't like Danielle, but the economy, but the energy sector, and also but Jagmeet Singh. Those are kind of the buts that we would hear at the doors. And so getting our way around that is interesting because Rachel Notley actually had an outstanding energy record. Not only was she able to make movement on climate change, but she also got the Trans Mountain expansion built with little help from me and the federal government. I will say that it was a tripartite decision, but the feds are the ones who spent all the money, so we have to be thankful to them. By the way, ask me how much it's killing me that that one particular project, which I did not expect it would go, you know, six times over budget and way over time, but that that one project is expected in this quarter to add 25 basis points to Canada's GDP nationally, one project. And that one project has already shrunk the differential of the Western Canada Select and the WTI. So in other words, it has essentially been the equivalent of already about a $10 a barrel increase in the price of oil in Canada. And what that means, which is super frustrating for me, is that the current Conservative government, the UCP government of Danielle Smith, is going to get all the money and get all the credit. But in fact, Conservative governments federally and provincially in this country over the last two decades have built 0 miles of pipeline to Tidewater. It was the federal Liberals and the provincial NDP that got that done. And it's making a huge difference for the economy and I would argue for the environment. And I'll come back to that in a second. Mm-hmm. The other important thing to remember is that Alberta was the first place in Canada to price carbon under a Conservative government. And that the oil and gas industry in Alberta is actually far ahead of its own governments in figuring out how to get to net zero. You know, the oil and gas industry agreed to net zero by 2050 before the governments did, because they saw where the markets were going and what the markets were forcing them to do. And we have, I believe, the smartest people in the world on environmental issues working in the Alberta energy sector, because if you're smart and you want to solve problems, go to where the problems are the biggest. And so all of this is going on, but at the same time, the premier will not admit to it because it's not good for her brand. And so for example, she often says that she is committed to net zero by 2050, but then successively says no to any single initiative that might move us towards net zero by 2050. And it's clear what she's doing. She's trying to push the ball further down the field so that in 2045, it becomes someone else's problem. And governments of all stripes have been doing this for decades. And we've run out of time. The time for easy solutions on climate change is long past. So we've got to make tough solutions, wrenching solutions. And right now, what we need, I believe, is pragmatic, thoughtful government that knows how to make deals, that knows how to move forward. So it is true. It's absolutely true, for example, that the federal government's clean electricity regulation only impacts three provinces, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and New Brunswick. In Manitoba, you've already met it, or you're so close to meeting it, it doesn't matter because you have abundant hydro. But so it's clear it's going to be very hard to meet. So what you do at that point, what my instinct would be, is you go and you sit down with Minister Wilkinson at the federal government. Minister Guilbeault is a lost cause. You can't sit down with him, but you can sit down with Wilkinson and basically say, all right, let's make a deal. I can't do it by 2030. Maybe I can do it by 2038. We need to think about how we abate natural gas for peaking as we're investing in renewables. You make a deal. And instead, what Smith did is she not only didn't make a deal just to make a point, she put a ban on renewables in Alberta, scaring away. And by the way, the Alberta renewables industry was by far the largest renewables industry in Canada because the problems are bigger and we need to solve them. She scared away anywhere between $30 and $300 billion in investment, thousands of jobs, just to try and own the libs federally. And what Albertans are telling me is, look, we want to be an example for the world on how does an energy producing place fight climate change. We want to be world leaders in the climate fight instead of being bystanders to it. And right now we are at best bystanders. We are more like King Canute standing on the cliffs, trying to stop the waves from coming. The waves are coming. Our markets are changing. And, you know, as much as the premier says she hates electrical vehicle mandates, the fact remains that at some point there won't be industrial combustion cars being sold. There'll only be electric ones, and we lose a huge part of our market. That at some point, there's not going to be as many natural gas-fired electricity turbines, and we lose a big chunk of our market. And so instead of just letting that happen to us, Albertans are saying we have to be at the forefront of it. So make no mistake, I have been and continue to be a strong advocate for Canadian energy. I happen to think that providing clean, safe, green energy is one of the strongest poverty-fighting features in the world, and we can make a huge difference to the world. I also believe that in the short and medium term, exporting liquid natural gas to displace coal burning around the world is a huge impact on emissions. It's probably the single biggest thing that Canada can do to reduce emissions globally. And I believe in an all of the above strategy, but I also believe that we have to do that while showing the world that we take climate change seriously and exporting our ideas and our technologies on fighting climate change to the rest of the world. And we just don't have that now.
So you've sort of hit on in that answer a lot of the things that many of us that are sort of sitting in the peanut gallery find maddening about politics right now, which is that truth and fact don't seem to have a lot of traction. So you can have a government like the UCP polling at somewhere between 45 and 50% support in voter intention with, outrageous, illogical governing decisions, the Liberals getting no love on Trans Mountain, and despite the fact that it's one of the biggest things that's ever happened to the Alberta energy sector. You mentioned the election here in Manitoba. So one of the interesting things about the election here is that Wab Kanu and the NDP ran a very progressive campaign, and they were confronted by largely incompetent government running a very toxic campaign. And Wab did win a majority, but only by 20,000 votes province-wide. It was very, very tight. Toxic and incompetent seems to have a lot of traction right now. How do you combat, or do you, I'm wondering if you lose sleep at night, wondering how you can actually sort of get people to wake up and smell the facts?
Well, I mean, that's sort of why I'm back in the world that I'm in now. But just to be contrarian.
Oh, please.
I'll push back on you just a teensy bit, which is one real challenge that progressives have everywhere is that we assume that we're right and that people who are not supporting us just don't know, or they've been fed too much misinformation. And if only they knew what we know, they would obviously change their vote and vote for us. It hasn't been that successful as a philosophy. And so what we need to do as more thoughtful, progressive people is really to be listening to folks and to be saying, all right, help me understand what's going on here. You know, there was a famous book written probably 25 years ago now called The Trouble with Kansas. And it sort of started with the question, why do folks in rural America vote against their self-interest? And it, of course, found out that the answers are much, much deeper and much more complex than that. And, you know, look, for some reason, for some people, they might be a one-issue voter. They might be really concerned about vaccine mandates. They might be really concerned about abortion or whatever. They might really be concerned about a backlash against gay rights. But, and so nothing else matters. They're voting only based on that. And that happens on all sides of the spectrum. So for example, you know, in the upcoming US election, we're going to have a bunch of voters who care only about Palestine and Gaza. And how are they going to play that out? And because they feel that Joe Biden hasn't done enough against the government of Israel. And you could easily argue, well, if you don't vote for Biden, you're going to get someone who is much less friendly to Muslim causes generally, but the Palestinian cause more specifically. And so for a lot of folks, you think, well, that's kind of illogical. But you also have to understand that for normal human beings, they're seeing what they view as unbelievable suffering of women and children, and nothing else matters. And so it's really important for us to be able to spend time with citizens to talk about things. So what's interesting is we probably have a very similar electorate to Manitoba in that, as you say, the NDP and the UCP are kind of within spitting distance of one another. The UCP sort of slightly ahead, inside or outside of the margin of error, in each polling between 45 and 48, 50%. The NDP's vote is much more efficient. So if we come up with a system where the UCP gets 48, 49% of the popular vote and the NDP gets 45, the NDP gets a majority government, depending on where the votes play out in which ridings. But I think for the NDP to be legitimate, they actually have to be competitive everywhere. So you can't say, look, let's elect the former mayor of Calgary as our leader and expect him to win six more seats in Calgary, and then we will have an NDP majority government. That is mathematically true. And if, in fact, you took the map of Calgary where I won three times and overlaid it over where the NDP needs seats, you would, in fact, have an NDP majority government. But it's not that simple. You have to re-win every single vote. You have to go back and re-win and get more. But also, I believe that you have to be competitive throughout the province, in rural areas and smaller communities, so that you have legitimacy in government. And, you know, I think it can be hard, just like the federal government with no, in the previous election, not this past one, but the one before, with no seats in Alberta or Saskatchewan and just a small handful in Manitoba, to be a legitimate national governing force where you don't have representatives in a huge chunk of your country. And God bless Jim Carr. You know, he works so hard to ensure that the prairies were heard around that table. But you've got to try and build that legitimacy as much as you can. And that's one of the challenges that the NDP is going to face. So even if I am successful on the 22nd, even if I win in a landslide victory, God willing, that means the real hard work is just beginning. And the hard work of getting us to where we need to be in time for the election is going to be grueling and difficult, but it has to be respectful. It has to be focused on listening to what people really need and not just saying, why are you listening to toxic, false information? You know, you should be better than that. You can't lecture people like that, I don't think.
I mean, that kind of message, though, and I wonder about what you often call the purple politics, or the kind of ways in which they're sort of building bridges. I mean, that this election campaign amongst the NDP has been quite markedly kind, or quite markedly at least listening to each other. I mean, even the other night, I think you were all taking a picture together with wearing Oiler jerseys. And there's kind of this.
Oh, yeah. This, I don't know.
How interesting. Actually, I think what I want to do is really ask you the question I think that's been burning on everybody's mind. How can you be the mayor of Calgary and put on an Oiler jersey? Isn't that like antithetical? Or did you feel like you were going to burst into flames? What's the heck?
Look, this has been a problem. people keep reminding me that I'm running for premier of the whole province. They used to be called the Alberta Oilers, by the way. Did you know that? Before the Calgary Flames existed. no, this has been a very serious concern for me. I will tell you, we'll have some fun with it. I will tell you that I had some fun at the beginning of the campaign because I was doing an event in Edmonton. And I just said, look, I'm a Calgarian. I don't even have an Oilers jersey. And I talked about how the former Premier Jim Prentice, I'm more of a football guy, and the former Premier Jim Prentice used to show up at Stamps Eskimos games wearing this god-awful, ugly Alberta jersey. Says Premier on the back. And I said, you know, Jim, everybody knows you're from Calgary. Like, you don't have to be inauthentic about this, right? So I'm telling the story in Edmonton, and I'm in kind of a fancy office. And the guy who is running the place, that was my very kind host, goes, oh, well, the good news is I have a closet full of them. I give them to my clients. So he went into the closet and found a McDavid away jersey that fit me. And he's like, you're going to need this. And so then I did a whole bit, which I thought was hysterical. I don't know if everyone thought it was hysterical, but I basically did a video standing on the streets of Edmonton saying, listen, here's what you don't know about me. I grew up in the 80s in Calgary and in Red Deer County. And Red Deer split right in the middle, eh? If you're in the south part of Red Deer, you're a Flames fan. If you're in the north part of Red Deer, you're an Oilers fan, though, because the Flames have not been great over the last little while. I think the Oilers have pretty much taken over Red Deer now. But in any case, I just said, I've been an Oilers fan my entire life. I can't tell people that, but I love them. And then I was like, I want to show you my most prized possession, which is my battle-worn jersey that I've been wearing for years and years and years. And I show this obviously brand new Connor McDavid jersey, and we zoom in on the price tag that's still on it. And then I say, yeah, I'm not like the UCP. I can't lie.
Oh, nice
one. At the end of that video, I actually say, look, it's going to take a lot to get me back in this jersey. It's probably going to take a very deep playoff run. And so someone sent me that clip back. And they were like, very deep playoff run, did you say? But yeah. I got to tell you, something exciting has happened here, which is that the bandwagon is real. That we have a Canadian team that may finally bring the cup back for the first time since 1993. With a group of generational talent and, you know, basically a team that's got a great culture. You know, there's a reason they play La Bamba after every game. There's a reason that it's called the Moss Pit, where people come together, named after their longtime dressing room attendant, Joey Moss, who had Down syndrome and loved La Bamba. So it's not impossible to love this team right now. But as I said in the debate the other day, oh, don't expect me to be rooting for them in the fall.
Well, we don't have that problem in Manitoba. We just have one team that we luckily enough can all get behind. But I think certainly
there was a point where we had a campaign meeting on the topic of what happens if it's the Oilers versus the Jets. And I was like, but I love the Jets.
Oh, see, now you're just pandering. But I will remind you that pandering. Last time they met, we swept you. So,
yeah. Well,
as I've been saying the last few weeks in my stump speech, I've been loving getting to know Edmonton better during the campaign because I'm spending a lot of time up there and seeing its natural beauty, its river valley, its culturally diverse neighborhoods. But the most surprising thing as a Calgarian about Edmonton is apparently, and this was a shocker to me, there is still hockey in May and June.
You got to lean into it, man. You got to lean into
it. You got to lean in. And it is the case. And for those who haven't been following this super carefully, what Nagan was referring to is that in the debate that we just did yesterday as we're recording this, it was like the sweetest debate of all time. In fact, I was like, people watching it must have been like, what's happening?
The debate? Shockingly kind.
And the last couple have been a bit feistier, but this one, I don't know, was very kind. There was like very, very, very few sparks. But the thing that surprised me is that one of my competitors, you get one question you get to ask to the opponents. So here's your chance to trip them up. Here's your chance to trap them. And she started, and I thought she was going somewhere else. And finally she said, so I'm going to ask the hardest question of all. Whose jersey are you wearing tonight for game six. And so I'm a very bad stand-up comic at heart and a bad improviser at heart. So I walked off stage. I just turned around and walked off the stage. And people were like, what is happening? And what I did was I walked off the stage to grab the jersey that I had waiting there to bring back up on stage for like a bit, for a moment, the one with the price tag on it. The funniest part, though, which I will tell only Manitoba listeners, because surely this will never get back to Alberta. When I walked off the stage, I went the wrong way and I got 100% lost backstage. And I was just like, where's my jersey? Where's the chair I left it on? What happened? And a kind stage manager volunteer knew what I was trying to do and came running across the backstage with my jersey in her hand, going, get back on stage.
Well, huge, you know, from Treaty One and Homeland of the Red River Métis and Manitoba, it's been real interesting to watch, especially considering the last provincial election that we went through, and then watching the kind of interesting trends that Alberta is going into that is somewhat unexpected.
We both have Indigenous premiers now, so that's something.
Oh, I'm so
looking at his face, folks. You cannot see his face.
I'm not going there.
I'll just explain my joke, which is that our premier at some point, well, way back when, there's a column where she claimed she was Métis, but not understanding what Métis means. She thought it just meant mixed blood. And during the election, she claimed that her great-great-grandmother, I think it was two greats, had Cherokee blood. It's always Cherokee. I don't know why it's always Cherokee.
I remember this fondly. It was kind of Canada's... what's her name? That presidential candidate who...
Elizabeth Warren.
Elizabeth Warren moment. Warren. Yes, it was...
And yeah, kind of- so APTN did the investigative journalism, found out there was no truth to it. And yet she never really apologized or anything. She just said, oh, well, family lore.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, Nagan, I cut you off. I just couldn't resist.
That was a good story.
From, you know, watching from here in Manitoba, it's been fascinating. It's really fascinating to watch you get back into politics. We've known each other for quite a while on the speaker circuit. And kind of, I still think one of the best speeches I've ever heard given in my life was your opening speech at the Governor General Leadership Awards, which was, you talked about the relationship between Indigenous peoples and immigrants and kind of this being in the center of Calgary, which I thought was a really, really beautiful. I wish that was transcribed somewhere. But we wish you nothing but the best. I mean, I cannot imagine entering politics now. I can't imagine it. If the toxicity and the vitriol, I was out with a friend last night who's a Crown prosecutor, and he at one time, like myself, have been approached by parties, plural, to run for office. And I could not imagine blowing up my life like that. So mostly for the most part, because of the violence that you'd have to endure, never mind all the smearing, all the other things that happen, and the fact that you put your family on the line. So anyone who runs for public office is pretty remarkable in my books. So what a sacrifice you must,
be. Thank you for saying that. And it is a sacrifice. I'm lucky that I don't have kids, and it's a little easier for me to manage just logistically. But at the same time, and it's harder and harder and harder to attract good people into politics. And you end up in sort of a vicious circle. But ultimately, the players make the game. And if you don't have players on the field who are willing to stand up for what's right, it's not just going to happen. So, you know, Dr. King talks about the long arc of moral history bending towards justice. But you rarely hear the second part of the quote, which is that that doesn't just happen. You have to grab that arc and pull it towards justice. And so it's important that we get in there, because the toxicity only ends when people who are willing to stand up to the toxicity are in the game. So it's going to be hard for me. I'm a feisty guy. I don't mind being pugilistic and putting up my dukes. You know, at one point I said something a bit mean recently about the UCP caucus, and I was called out on it. And I said, you're right, I was too polite. And NDP people were shocked, right? And so I'm going to have to be careful. is I get into this toxic pool that I don't drown in it. But at the same time, I also believe that if you don't have people in there that are actively fighting against it, that you're not going to get the kind of politics that we deserve. Because I believe politics matters. I believe government matters. I believe setting the tone is just as important as providing the services. And, you know, that's why I'm watching Manitoba so carefully. Because if there's one, you know, and I don't know enough to say whether the premier is doing a great job on his job. But what I can tell you is the tone he's setting and the brand he's building for Manitoba is unbelievable. Much in the way that my friend Brian Bowman, the former mayor of Winnipeg, when, you know, he was faced with a magazine cover that said Winnipeg is the most racist city in Canada. And instead of denying it, as would have been my instinct, he leaned into it and talked about how we are going to change that perception by not being the most racist city in Canada. That's leadership. And the kind of tone that I'm seeing from your premier now in saying that we're standing up to that kind of toxicity and we're building a place that people can be proud of. Look, if I can follow in those footsteps, I think we'll be doing good for the country.
Well, listen, thank you so much. I know this is the kind of the calm before the storm as people flock to vote online and maybe drop a few ballots in the mailbox. But, you know, you're a pretty good egg for spending some time with us, at this critical moment. And who knows if we're lucky, Wab Kanu's already officially a friend of the podcast. He's appeared 3 times. So awesome. You only have 2 more to go. Before you can,
you know, next time in Winnipeg, we'll do it live walking across the street at Portage in Maine.
When the barriers come down.
Thanks so much for coming, and miigwech.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care.
You know, it's hard for me not to be a bit of a fanboy here. I'm not a voter in Alberta. I'm not a member of the NDP party. But, you know, this guy, for anybody who wishes government to be progressive and open-minded and reasonable, not trying to extend to the extremes of the political spectrum in the country. You know, this guy is inspiring, to say the least. And I mean, I know that in the current environment, he will be disparaged and dismissed by people, you know, on the extremes, even, you know, the extreme within the NDP party, some of the hardliners, trade unionists and whatever don't, you know, think he's a carpetbagger. But, you know, the point is, like, he's a man of vision and sort of, I would say, measured sensibilities. Like, he's really open to what other people think and want and feel. And that's a rarity.
There's a sort of message my father has always reminded me is that to be a politician or to be a good politician, regardless of what political stripe that you are in, you have to love people. You have to love the people, like capital T, capital P. And one thing about Nahid Nenshi is there is clear love for the people. And bringing people together is his MO through reasoned conversation, through dialogue and debate and ideas. And oddly enough, that may be a bit rarer to find these days about ways that finding politicians that can build bridges. But the best part of that interview, I think by far, and any of you who appreciate good history, is hearing about all the people he went to school with. Like imagine the University of Calgary just walking around the hallways at that time in which he was describing almost the who's who of Alberta and federal Liberal politics.
It was the next 30 years of Alberta politics and Alberta politicians, you know, that would make their mark on the national stage. Yeah. But it also goes to show to, you know, like this is a guy who has spent time talking to and listening to people with different ideas.
And sometimes radically different ideas, like Ezra Levant.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We're going to move past that now. Just,
yeah, hey, listen.
But I forced him. He kept referring to him as he who shall not be named, and I made him name him. So it's my fault.
On the pod. Yeah. Well, anyways, great interview. We say a big miigwech to not just Nahit, but all of his team. I mean, his team for weeks talked with us, texted with us, tried to find a good spot because he is on the campaign trail. As we were speaking with him, literally there were people just beginning to vote in the NDP Alberta leadership campaign. So we're very lucky that we got that 1 hour for a great interview. You know, Dan, I just want to say we're not going to do probably a pod for at least till after Father's Day. And I want to say Happy Father's Day to you.
Thanks. Well, at least now someone said Happy Father's Day.
I was going to say, do your kids say Happy Father's Day? I've been over to your house a few times and so, they love you, but sometimes they wonder why you're there.
First of all, first of all, some of my daughter's best friends like the podcast. So this is getting back to her in a hurry. But no, seriously, my kids are great. Like they are, my kids are both incredible good people. And they're doing great things, and I love them, and I couldn't be more proud of them. And if my wife didn't remind them constantly in the week before Father's Day, it would be like it never happened. So, but that's okay, because it's not like Father's Day is not really a big deal. Like I've actually, we're in a process now of saying like, don't give me anything. I don't need anything. Make me a meal. Take me out for a meal. And they will. You know, probably do that. But Father's Day falls on a Sunday. Both of my kids are bartenders.
That's I was going to say working people.
Yeah, they're hardworking people, bartenders, which means they work late and they get up late. So I have a funny feeling, you know, that they're both going to get up around 11:45. They're going to toast me an English muffin, pat me on the back, and then they're going back to bed. So.
Well, I'm going to get a text because I will likely be we actually have ceremonies next week. So every year for Midewin people, we always have ceremonies according to the moon. And so and it seems every single year two things happen during our summer ceremonies in June. And my sister's birthday is always in the middle of it. So she always gets to celebrate in the lodge and our ceremonies. And then on top of that, Father's Day is always on that Sunday. So we usually are headed on the road and driving back from Wisconsin on that day. So I usually have Father's Day with a gas station coffee. That's usually my celebration for it. But I probably get a text this year.
And a Krispy Kreme donut.
And maybe in full circle, a Krispy Kreme donut.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in again. We have a couple more potentially big interviews to finish off this season before we take our summer hiatus. So if you can, keep talking and do message us on social media or email us if you want a t-shirt. We got our
first official pre-order online. And I actually was so loud, I posted it on my Twitter page. Say, hey, Dan, we got our pre-order. And you were excited, too.
We're so close to T-shirts. I can practically taste the pot and collie blend.
Yeah. Which is a shame for both of us.
Okay. That's right. Thanks, everybody. And we will see you in a couple weeks.